Tanya 200. In chapter 32 of Tanya, where the Rebbe speaks about loving your fellow Jew as yourself, the Rebbe mentions that there are certain people who, because of their sinfulness, we are obligated to hate them. And the Rebbe explains that these people are those who are our peers, our classmates, those who have had all the advantages we have had, and therefore has no excuse for his sins. And the fact that we see their misbehavior can only mean that we are obligated to do something about it. And so we take responsibility for the misbehavior, and we try to correct it. And if after chastising and doing everything we can to stop the person from sinning, he continues to sin, then and only then is there a mitzvah to actually hate him. In addition to this, the mitzvah, the commandment to love your fellow Jew, has no exceptions. It applies to every Jew. The Jew who we are obligated to hate brings an additional obligation. It doesn't displace the original obligation to love your fellow Jew. So this person who is our peer, who does know better, or should know better, who has studied and knows everything we know, and should be as inspired as we are, and yet he continues to sin, this is a Jew, and we have an obligation to love him, but this is also a person who is in trouble, and we have an obligation to hate him. So we have two obligations, to both love and hate. How do you have both love and hate for the same person? Well, the simple answer is, you hate the bad in him, and you love the good in him. But that's too simple. If you love the good and hate the bad, you've divided the person into qualities, goodness and wickedness. What about the person himself? If we were to come to someone and say, this friend of yours, this classmate of yours, do you like him or don't you like him? And you say, well, I like the good in him, I don't like the bad in him. That doesn't answer the question. The person himself, do you like him or not like him? Chances are that if you dislike the bad in him, then you dislike him to some degree. The general him, the person himself. That's why the Rebbe goes on to say that in addition to hating the wicked within him and loving the good within him, you also have to feel compassion. You have to arouse a feeling of compassion. And that is that the good in him, the godly soul in him, must be suffering because of its exile, because of its imprisonment in the wickedness, in the evil, in the sinfulness. What does this compassion do? We are told that compassion removes anger and brings back love. So this compassion will soften the hatred of the bad within the person and bring out the love that you feel for the good within the person. And then, in general, as a person, you will like rather than dislike this friend of yours who you have an obligation to hate. So you will hate only the evil, not the person. But how does that happen? Only if you bring out the compassion that moves you from the hate to the love. But if you simply have hatred for what is bad and love for what is good, the person gets lost in this. You're looking at qualities, not at a human being. So to like the human being, it's not enough to have a balance of hate, love and hate for the good and the wicked within him. You have to have compassion for the good, which brings you more towards the right, more towards the love than the hate, so that you actually like the person himself. Now, all of this is the result of joy. The benefits of simcha. When a person is happy because of his own godly soul and can't afford to be distracted by the wickedness of his own evil inclination or animal soul, then he can love his fellow Jew as a Jew, because it's the Jewishness in the other person that he notices and that he gives attention to. And then, even if this fellow Jew is so bad that he has to hate him also, the joy that he feels for the godly soul will overrule, will outweigh the hatred that he feels for the evil within his friend. And he will, in fact, love his fellow Jew as a person, even while he hates the evil within him. Chapter 33. The Rebbe says that this joy can become even more intense, greater, by the following considerations. There are actually two kinds of joy. One comes from the fact that God created the world in order to have a dwelling place for himself in the most ungodly of creation, in the most ungodly creatures. What is the most ungodly of creatures? The evil inclination in the human being. And there, God wants to have a dwelling place. God wants us to love him even with our evil inclination. When we do mitzvahs, and when we serve God, we are actually creating that dwelling place for him. How great that joy should be. The Rebbe compares it to a king who invites himself over to your house. There's a great joy in having an invitation where you are invited to come to the king's house. It's a great joy. It's an even greater joy when the king will come to your house. He wants to live in your world. He wants to be with you in your reality. That's an even greater joy. When the King of Kings says, "Make me a home in your world," what greater joy, what greater reason to rejoice than that? First of all, the justification. We are not hopeless. We are not worthless. We are not condemned. This unholy condition in which we find ourselves, this is where God wants to be. So the unholiness is not the end of the road. It is not our doom. It's our opportunity to make of this unholiness a place for God by elevating it and by drawing it into godliness and turning it into the greatest holiness of all. That itself is a great joy. But the fact that God desires it, the fact that God wants it, that, more than anything else, gives us reason to rejoice. And then the Rebbe compares that to an inheritance. A great wealth that comes to you through inheritance. You didn't work for it. You didn't do anything special to deserve it. You didn't put any great effort into it, and all of a sudden it's yours. That's a great joy. And that's only human, financial, monetary, materialistic. Here we have a great inheritance. Without effort, and without struggle, and without having to do anything to deserve it, God invites himself into our world before we do anything. Which means that the human being, as a human being, with all the faults of a human being, has a great mission, a purpose. And this is the purpose. This is the mission for which all the worlds were created, including the human being, to make for God this dwelling place. So the meaningfulness that is given to us without our efforts just as an inheritance, a gift from above. That is a great cause for joy and for happiness for the rest of our lives. Life is good. Life is meaningful. Life is essential to the vast eternal plan for which God created the world in the first place. And that's just the beginning. There's a greater joy. The greater joy is this. We are thrilled to be invited for the privilege of making a dwelling place for God in the lowest world. The meaning that that gives to our lives, the direction, the purpose, the focus, the light, that's a great joy. But that's quite incidental to the vast eternal plan itself. The plan itself is that God desires a dwelling place in the lower world. And when the lower world becomes a dwelling place for God, this gives God great joy. God rejoices with his creation, is happy with his creation. It's giving him pleasure. The realization that we can give God pleasure is, of course, a great privilege and a great joy. But it doesn't compare at all to the fact that God feels the joy and gets pleasure from what we're doing. In other words, there is the pleasure I feel when I am privileged to do something for you, and then there is the fact that you enjoyed what I did. Now, I can either enjoy my privilege of serving you, or I can join you in your joy. I can either be happy because my life is good, because I can serve you, or I can be happy because you're happy. Your happiness is my happiness. Even if I wasn't the one who contributed to your happiness, just seeing that you're happy is a reason for me to rejoice. In other words, because of our relationship to God, his joy is our joy, even if we didn't do anything to produce it. When your father is happy, for whatever reason, you're happy with him, in his joy. And therefore, everyone should join in God's happiness and share in the joy that God is getting from his creation when people do mitzvahs, or when we do mitzvahs. And that, of course, is the highest form of joy. Rejoicing in someone else's joy. And when we apply that to God, it is the ultimate of the ultimate joy. Sharing, feeling, experiencing the joy that God is feeling because his world is producing and becoming what he wants it to be. Now, in order to fully appreciate this, we have to understand and appreciate the oneness of God. The oneness of God means that there is no existence other than him. There is no reality other than him. And when we say God is one, we don't mean that there's only one God. We mean that there's only one. There's only one. Only one is. Nothing else is. And that means that all of creation, this vast universe, or universes, everything God created, which seems to have an existence of its own in addition to God's existence, which means that God is and the world is, that's only on the surface. It only appears that way. Because God created the world purposely, intentionally, in such a way that the world should look different and separate. Different from him and separate from him. In other words, the creator should not be evident in his creation. But that's just the surface. Beyond the surface, in reality, the world is not a world. It's not an existence, finite, material, physical, distinct and separate from God. Rather, it too is God. There's nothing besides God. And how do we figure this? How do we rationalize this? The world exists only through constant divine intervention. Meaning to say that God has to be creating the world at all times. And how does he create the world? Through speech. God said, let there be. Now this speech has an existence of its own, or doesn't it? In the human being, when we speak, we create a reality outside of ourselves. Once I have said the word, once I've spoken out loud, the spoken word becomes a reality separate from me. Of course, I created that word, I produced that word, but once I let it out, once I articulate it, it's no longer mine. It has an existence of its own. So there's me and what I said. And as we all know, what I said can come back to haunt me. It can come back and destroy me. Because it has become a monster. It has taken on a will of its own, a life of its own, a reality of its own, and I can't control it anymore. Which is one of the very good reasons for being careful what we say. But that's only in the human being. In God, when God says, the word never leaves him because there's no place besides him. And so the spoken word in God remains within him, not outside of him. Now, when the spoken word is still within me, within the human soul, it doesn't have an identity of its own. It doesn't have a being of its own. It is not. Only I am. So before I say anything, I am a human being capable of speech. But where is this speech? In my mind. It's in thought. I haven't said it yet. But if I trace it back further, the spoken word doesn't begin in my thoughts. It begins in my feelings. Because what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about something I feel. So first it's a feeling, then it becomes a thought, and then it can become a word, a spoken word. And even feelings are not the beginning. The beginning is thought, is awareness, knowledge. When I become aware of something, and I have a feeling about it, then that can become a thought, which will eventually become a word. People speak in different languages. People think in different languages. Because thought and speech both have a language. They have letters by which they function. Emotion doesn't have letters. A feeling doesn't have a language. And so we can't say, this guy loves in Spanish. Love doesn't have a language. And that's because it's an abstract, disembodied reality, and language is the body in which thought and speech express themselves. So emotions don't have a language, and certainly knowledge has no language. Every person who understands that 2 and 2 is 4 understands it the same way. They don't do it in different languages, because logic, again, is universal and common to all humans. Now, if we trace the thought back to the emotion back to the awareness, to the intelligence, in the intelligence, before I even have an emotion, before I even have a thought, and before I've said anything, I'm already capable of expressing what I know. Which means the words exist in the knowledge before it becomes an emotion, before it becomes a thought. But if you could enter into the brain where the knowledge takes place, you would see no words. You would see no letters. Although it's there, because if it wasn't there, I would never be able to express it. The fact that it can move, devolve, from the awareness to the emotion to the thought and then become a word means that it existed in the awareness. If I can say that 2 and 2 is 4, that ability to express existed when I first discovered that 2 and 2 is 4. But at that point, the spoken word was so absorbed within myself that it had no identity. You couldn't recognize it. You wouldn't spot it. You wouldn't see it. Only later, as it devolves, it takes on a visible personality with properties of its own and so on. So when the word is not spoken, it's still within the soul, and it exists there, certainly. But it is not a separate entity. It's simply part of what a soul is. So we wouldn't say that there, I noticed two things, a soul and its speech. There'd be only one thing, a soul. A soul can talk, but that's what a soul is. Speech is not a separate entity. And so when God speaks, when God says, let there be light, let us make man, he's not creating another reality. It's all within him. Because, again, unlike human speech, God's speech never leaves him. So that when God speaks, it's like the words that we don't speak. And so there's still only God, nothing besides him. Idolatry is the mistake of thinking that once God said, let there be, a being other than him came into existence. But that would mean that the word left God, and that obviously can't be because there's no place for it to go, because there's no place where God isn't. So it's always within God, and therefore the world has no existence of its own. Now, what does that do for us? The understanding, the awareness of God's oneness, that there is nothing besides God, means that we are not separate from God. It means that we are one with God. And that oneness is a great joy. And that's why the understanding and the belief in God's oneness has been considered the essence of all of Judaism, of all of Torah. As if there's only one commandment, and that is, believe in the oneness of God. The belief in the oneness of God produces a joy that animates and motivates the fulfillment of all the other 613 commandments. So it's not that believing in God is sufficient and you don't have to do the other commandments, but that belief in God is so empowering, it's so inspiring, that it animates and brings naturally the fulfillment of all the other commandments. If we were to experience and appreciate and understand properly the oneness of God, that our condition, our existence, although it may seem so ungodly, is really nothing other than God, because there is no other reality, that closeness, as we said before, God inviting himself into our world, into our understanding and into our experience, that is such a great joy that we can't possibly refuse any mitzvah that God asks of us. And we fulfill those mitzvahs with a great enthusiasm and with a great joy. So the method of serving God, the way Chabad understands it, in the way that Tanya presents it, follows a structure, an order, that begins in the mind. Understand the oneness of God, that's the beginning. Contemplate the oneness of God, explain it to yourself clearly, see it in your mind's eye, and that will produce a great joy. Joy, of course, involves the heart. So now we are serving God with our mind and our heart. But once you involve the heart, you can't just sit there anymore. The heart finds fulfillment and satisfaction in action or in speech. And so once the heart is excited and you now have a great joy that comes from the feeling of God's closeness, then you have to do something. You have to speak lovingly. You have to act lovingly. And how do we speak lovingly of God? By speaking His language, by using His words. How do we act lovingly to God? By doing His commandments, by fulfilling His needs, His will. And so here you have the entire structure. The mind inspires the heart. The heart animates the behavior, thought, speech, and deed. And then you have the complete observance and the complete fulfillment of all 613 mitzvahs, all due to one experience, and that is experiencing the oneness of God, where God invites Himself into our reality, because it's really all one. Our reality is all within Him, all part of Him, because there is nothing besides God.